Good evening and welcome. Sorry for our premature glimpse there. My name's Karen West, and on behalf of Book Passage and Dominican University of California, I invite you to this wondrous, sparky evening. Both of these women are such a blast. You are in for such a treat. A couple of things to start with. Tonight's event is being broadcast worldwide on Penguin Radio. If you would like to take a moment to call a friend and tell them so that they can listen in, please do it right now. The web address is very simple. It's radio.dominican.edu. So if you'd like to invite anybody to join us on the airwaves, do so now, and then I want you to do that thing where you slip it away quickly and turn it off. We'll be getting underway. We had handed out index cards for questions, but Cherie Blair has graciously agreed to take the questions from you personally in the audience. So I will be running around doing that Phil Donahue sort of microphone moment with you. So if you'll patiently await me, and I'll bring the mic to you. Also, Book Passage will have additional copies of her books to the right over here. Thank you so much for supporting independent bookselling and independent thinking here at Dominican University. Please, Dr. Denise Lucy.
Thank you, Karen, so much. Welcome. My name is Denise Lucy. I am a professor of business and leadership and the director of the Institute for Leadership Studies here at Dominican University, California, which is the organization that is sponsoring the lecture series. The series is an opportunity for our university to welcome our neighbors and our friends and our community to discuss and dialogue about ideas related to leadership across the disciplines, from business to politics, the arts, academia, science, technology, and I know that many of you have come to other lecture series events. The lecture series is really the public face of our institute. We offer leadership development here in Marin, and we hope that you may be interested and give us a call, and we'll talk with you more about how we might help you around your leadership development. The institute's mission is to advance the study, the teaching, and the practice of effective ethical leadership in our world. And it is a key component integral to the School of Business and Leadership, which is committed to educating students to be socially responsible and to make a positive difference in the world. Just in this last year, we've had speakers such as Al Gore, Madeleine Albright, Nancy Pelosi, Amy Tan, Isabel Allende, many, many different types of speakers. On October 27th, Monday, 1 week from tonight, Marian Wright Edelman will also be here, the founder of the Children's Defense Fund. It's a different time, 7:30 p.m., and it will not be in this building. It will be in the Shield Room. So for those of you who are attending, please note, 7:30 in the Shield Room. We also have an event this next Thursday, the 23rd of October, in the day. It's called from 9 to 11. You're all welcome to join us. It's called Vote Smart Challenge. And we have matched student and faculty teams among all different kinds of disciplines. They've researched over the summer and the fall important issues related to our country, and we'll have representatives from both the Obama campaign and the McCain campaign to also be in response to some of the issues being raised. It will be moderated by Alicia Shepherd, who's traveling back east, who's the NPR ombudswoman, who will moderate the event. So we hope that you'll come. It will involve some handheld devices where you'll vote from the audience on topics. So it'll be a very engaging experience. 9 a.m. in this building on the 23rd of October. I wanted to make note, too, before I make my introductions of our speaker tonight, is that we do have students in the audience, and we have an 8:15 class, 8:15 p.m. Now, aren't those dedicated people? 8:15 p.m., so at 8 o'clock, when the Q&A is about to begin, you will see a few students who will quietly leave and go to the next class. It's not because they're not interested, right? Right. I want to thank, of course, Book Passage, our very important partner, who makes these kinds of events happen. May we thank Book Passage, please. Let's do that. Also, Marin Magazine is our newest partner. They are our media sponsor, and we also would like to ask you to thank them as well. This evening, we are delighted to welcome Cherie Blair. Mrs. Blair is a leading human rights lawyer, a campaigner for women's equality, and the wife of Britain's former Prime Minister, Tony Blair. This evening, she will discuss her fascinating new autobiography, Speaking for Myself, My Life from Liverpool to Downing Street. I'd like to congratulate Mrs. Blair because she has a new venture. Last month, she announced the Cherie Blair Foundation for Women, which in partnership with other existing organizations that promote support for women's roles and leadership in the global economy, she will support women entrepreneurs in the developing world. Joining Mrs. Blair in tonight's discussion is Dr. Françoise Lepage. Dr. Lepage is the Dean Emerita for the School of Business and International Studies and currently the Assistant to the President for Special Projects and is an expert in international relations. Please welcome Mrs. Cherie Blair and Dr. Françoise Lepage.
Thank you. We are delighted to join you this evening. Thank you, Dr. Lucy. And Cherie, welcome to Dominican University of California. It's an honor to have you with us.
Delighted to be here. I already feel at home because it reminds me so much of my old school, actually. I can feel the nun's presence.
Yeah.
So I'm completely terrified.
Cherie, in a recent interview, you said about your new book, Speaking for Myself, that it was about a woman's 50-year journey. And although your stories about this journey introduce us to so many interesting people, I must admit that I was taken by your grandmother. She really is a pistol, and I'd like to know your thoughts on this relationship.
Well, my grandma and my mother are the two most important women in my life, that's for sure. And in fact, I dedicate the book to both of them. My grandmother was my father's mother, not my mother's mother. And unusually for my mother, when she became a single parent, she didn't live with her own mother. Her own mother died when she was 14. She lived with her mother-in-law. And my grandma was a formidable woman. She was one of those women who, within her own family and within the wider working-class community where I was brought up, was always known as a feisty woman. If you had anything you were complaining about or something was going wrong, if you went to see Vera Booth, she would probably do something about it. And she didn't take many prisoners, that's for sure.
Yeah. I especially appreciated, if you recall, out of all the stories in the book, the one about being sent to get some bread and coming home and confronting your grandmother with what you brought home.
No, I think my grandma was very well known in the neighborhood, and from a very early age, it's one of the reasons I have a good memory, is that my sister and I, we would be sent to do the messages, is what we called it. We'd go out. And my grandmother was always very strict. We used to go in and we'd say, you know, I want a loaf of fresh bread for Mrs. Booth. You know, and for Mrs. Booth was very important because the shopkeepers were supposed to know that if they tried to palm her off with yesterday's bread, there was going to be a big trouble. And indeed, you know, that happened. You know, if I came back and the bread wasn't squidgy enough, my grandma would send me back you know, insist that the shopkeeper change it.
Mrs. Booth was not satisfied,
no,
if I can remember.
No, that was the kiss of death for any shop.
Right. Your parents, Gail Howard and Tony Booth, obviously had a great influence on your life. Which of the two do you think had the strongest influence, if either?
No, it must have been my mother, because, of course, my father was mainly absent during my childhood. In fact, I can never really remember a time when my father lived with us. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, his politics and his presence, because I was living with his mother, there was that connection with him, because we were very much part of that extended family. And so for many times when my father, who, because he became quite a famous actor, and then he got into drinking and smoking dope, and he was rather a rebel, I'm the eldest of myself and my sister, But then we have 6 half-sisters that my father had with 4 other women. Mm-hmm. So he was a character. He still is a character. But my mum, of course, was the constant presence in my life. She was a woman who at 14 had to leave school because her own mother died and her father was a miner, and she had to stop school because somebody had to look after her father and her younger brother, who was only 10 at the time. And then when she was 18, her father, without really telling them, suddenly announced he was getting married again. And the day her stepmother walked in the front door, my mother walked out the back door, never to return. Mm-hmm. To live at home again. And then she went to RADA, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, and became an actress. Mm-hmm. And in the course of that, she went on tour in repertory theatres, travelling around England and Wales. And she was the juvenile female lead, and the juvenile male lead was none other than my father. And they did things like The Princess and the Swineherd, mm-hmm, together, and eventually The Princess did indeed succumb to the charms of the swineherd, and before they knew where they were. My mother at 21 was a mother with me. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then later on, when it was becoming more difficult after my sister was born for her to continue working as an actress, she ended up living with her mother-in-law. My father then came backwards and forwards for a bit, was supposed, mm-hmm, to go down to London, and we were supposed to join him, but mm-hmm, in the end, of course, it never happened. And what did happen was, I still remember it clearly to this day, that at the age of 8, suddenly in our local paper, there was a birth announcement announcing that my father and some other woman had just given birth to someone who's a big friend of mine now, who actually lives in America, my half-sister, Jenia. But you can imagine, this was 1963 in Catholic part of Liverpool, where we didn't divorce, wasn't, mm-hmm, even talked about. And my grandma was the parish priest's cousin. Mm-hmm. And so it was a huge scandal. And, yes, and for me, as a little girl, was the shame on the family. I mean, it made a big impact, uh-huh, on me. And one of the things it made me determined was that I would never bring shame on my mother and my, mm-hmm, grandmother. Mm-hmm.
And you seemed to find some comfort in many relationships, but another family member, your Aunt Audrey. And at 16, you said that you were very politically aware and you joined the Labour Party. Now, was it your Aunt Audrey that got you interested in politics?
It was partly my aunt and partly my father, her elder brother. Mm-hmm. But she was a big influence on me, and because when I was first born and I lived at my grandma's house, she was still at home, and it wasn't until I was 3 and I was her bridesmaid, mm-hmm, that she moved, mm-hmm, out. And then, of course, years later, she got breast cancer, and she died in 1987. Partly because when she was first found the lump, she didn't say anything and didn't do anything. And as a result of that, when she did eventually go to the doctors, in fact, she came over here to America to a friend's of theirs, and she mentioned to her friend that she had the lump, and her friend had her round to the hospital, and mm-hmm, mm-hmm, but within 4 years, she was dead. And later on, I became patron of Breast Cancer Care, which is a big charity in the UK which deals with breast cancer, and got involved very much with campaigns about making sure that women are aware of their bodies and are not frightened or inhibited from coming forward. It's not so much of a problem, of course, nowadays, mm-hmm, in places like America or in Britain. But just a few years ago, I went with Breast Cancer Care to Pakistan, and in places like that, mm-hmm, women still, you know, they're not taught to value themselves, they're not taught to be comfortable about their bodies. And the consequence of that is that, whereas in our countries today, 80% of the women who present with breast cancer have grade 1 or grade 2 tumours, which are basically treatable. Mm-hmm. In Pakistan, and in countries like Pakistan, 80% of the women who present with breast cancer have grade 3 or grade 4 tumours. Wow. And essentially, that is about palliative care and managing, you know, what are and could be unnecessary deaths. And I always think that my aunt's death was an unnecessary death. And again, that I owe it to her to make sure that I do all I can to make sure that doesn't happen to other women too.
You talked also about your days at the London School of Economics. And in fact, many of us can reflect to those days of apartments that are less than palatial, as we say. I was wondering, as an educator, we always like to believe that we have some impact on our students. Whether or not that's true, we're never sure.
Oh, it's definitely true, honestly.
At the London School of Economics, or throughout any time in your education, was there a particular teacher, faculty, mentor that made a difference for you?
There were a number of people who made a difference to me. In fact, I was talking again about when I was 8 and all this happened, and I started to be, you know, a bit naughty in the playground, and there was a woman teacher who was my teacher at the time who said to my mother, you know, Cherie needs a challenge. And what happened was I was moved up from what would be in your terms, I think, fourth grade to sixth grade, and missed out a grade. Because of that, you know, I sort of rose to the challenge and actually went on and became top of my class even in the sixth grade. So she, you know, she made a difference to me. Or the deputy head of my primary school, who was an extraordinary man who, as well as being a teacher, was a part semi-professional singer and ran the choir, and he made a difference. And then, of course, you ask about the LSE. I mean, we had some fantastic professors. And I was very privileged. My husband went to Oxford, and he read law in a much more traditional way. I went to the LSE, where they taught it much more as part of social sciences and social policy. Mm-hmm. And I always loved reading law, and I've always enjoyed being a lawyer, whereas I think Tony actually always regretted doing law at university.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of your husband, it was an interesting history, which I think the audience would find very interesting as well, is with your life in law, he started as a rival.
He did.
He evolved to a boyfriend.
He did.
And he evolved finally to your husband. So how did he go from rival to husband?
Because anyone who knows my husband knows he's got irresistible charm. And so, though he was my rival, and actually we were both competing for the same, the first time I met him, actually, we were both competing for the same scholarship. And that one I did get, rather than him. But then we were working together for over a year, and my problem was, and this is something I confess in the book, that whilst I was starting to get to know Tony, and one of the things we used to like when we were working together to talk about was not just about politics, but actually about religion, because you know what, many, you know, in 1975, 76, though I had been a good Catholic girl, I possibly wasn't as good a Catholic girl as I should have been by then. And so I didn't often talk about religion with someone. Tony was someone, actually, who was interested in that, and that was an affinity that we still have. But he was also, of course, very charming. But I had a boyfriend already. In fact, I had two. Because I had my old boyfriend who was in Liverpool, and we'd been going out for 3 or 4 years then, and I think my mother and he, they all thought I would come back to Liverpool after I trained in London and live there. But I realized that actually if I wanted to do the sort of human rights and employment, women's rights work that I wanted to do, I had to do that really in London. Mm-hmm. And so while I was in London on my own, I started going out with a London boyfriend. So I had my London boyfriend and I had my Liverpool boyfriend. And every time I went back to Liverpool, I thought, I really must tell David, you know, this is not fair. But, you know, I'd see him and he was such a nice boy. And so I put it off again until one day he actually came down to visit me unexpectedly and found the London boyfriend in my flat. Not, I can assure you, doing anything untoward, but the fact he was there and obviously quite comfortable there meant that that was the end of that relationship. And then, of course, along comes Tony. And
That's the next book.
That's right. Well, I kept trying to say to him, no, we're not really going out. We're just friends. But, you know, he then would start introducing me to his friends as his girlfriend. And eventually I realized that he was the one for me.
Uh-huh. And your life with the former prime minister has had its challenges as a result of the public life. But I think, if I understood correctly, that experience really started in your law profession, in a way, of confronting old mores and trying to establish what the appropriate role is for an individual. And you posed, I think, a very difficult mm-hmm. question. And in fact, it's a question that we discuss quite often. And I'll quote it directly so that I have it accurately. As a woman, how do you develop a style in a man's world when what works for a man is regarded as inappropriate for a woman?
I think it was a real issue. It still is a real issue. And when I was writing the book, actually, it was also during the time that Hillary was running for president. And I thought, you know, that there's a real question here that she was addressing mm-hmm. there. But back in the 1970s, when there still were very few women going into the law, I mean, I rather naively thought that just because I was a bright girl and because I came top of the bar exams, mm-hmm. that somehow, and the nuns had always made me think that as long as you were good at what you did, you could do anything, and the LSE had reinforced that. And it was only when I went to the bar that I suddenly discovered that I had a really big disadvantage, and that disadvantage was simply that I was a girl, and I was only 21. I was very young, and I looked about 12. And there were, and I hadn't been to a public school, which is what we call private schools there. Mm-hmm. So I was a working class girl. So maybe I didn't have that social elegance that some others had. And actually, my husband had, having gone to a public school, and there were very few women. My class was the first time that the number of women students being called to the bar went over into double figures. And so, you know, you go into a place and they would say, well, we don't take women. Mm-hmm. And you'd say, oh, well, okay, that's obviously fine, you know, because that was just the way it was in those days. And mm-hmm. when it came to the place where I was working to choose between myself and Tony, I mean, my boss said to me quite clearly, well, you know, you're the girl and he's the boy, so obviously we'd go for the boy. And, of course, it was also that you didn't, you know, I'd go into a courtroom and I would be the only woman there. Mm-hmm. And my pupil master, my boss, if you like, had a particularly effective but aggressive style of crossing. He was a very aggressive courtroom advocate, you know, that would make people quake in their mm-hmm. boots. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was a huge admirer of his, but I rapidly came to realize that, you know, if I went in and started attempting to bully somebody, I mean, it wouldn't work because I'm not really that sort of person. Mm-hmm. But I was very lucky because I saw very early on a sort of legal case, which was between Derry Irvine, who later became the Lord Chancellor, mm-hmm. the head of the judiciary in my husband's government, against somebody who became Lord Bingham, who was the most senior, eventually became the most senior judge, mm-hmm. professional judge, as opposed to Derry, who was a politician by then in England. And Lord Bingham had, that time when he was just still an advocate, had a completely different approach. It was a much more subtle approach. I said, mm-hmm. I think in the book, that Derry was more like a rhinoceros, and Tom Bingham was more like a snake. Mm-hmm. And I realized that, that, you know, a more subtle approach was a better way for me. Yeah. And when I was writing the book, I was thinking about it because of Hillary. And because all the time when she was standing, and of course she's a friend of mine and I know her, people were calling her shrill or aggressive in a way that, you know, they wouldn't necessarily have said the same thing about a man. And mm-hmm. for a woman to find her voice in a man's world can be difficult.
Yes.
And I think the biggest mistake we can make is to actually try and be like the men, because the great thing about it is that women are different from men, and in fact we'll be different from other women. Mm-hmm. But the diversity is the strength, and different styles can work. And I think by the end of her campaign, when Hillary made that speech about the 18 million cracks in the glass ceiling, I think she had proved categorically that a woman could become president. Yes. Of the United States. And I'm sure one day a woman will become president, and when they do, they will acknowledge that what Hillary proved, that she had the tenacity, that she had the capacity, that she had the intelligence, and that she had the sheer perseverance to withstand that hugely stressful experience, which it is. I mean, our campaigns don't take half as long as the campaigns that the candidates are going through now, that they will acknowledge that debt to Hillary.
Yes, good point. In preparing for tonight's conversation, one of my colleagues recommended that I read some of the British press.
That was a very bad idea.
Yes. I think I met rhinoceros and snakes at the same time, perhaps. But Diane Sawyer, in her interview recently, she said that you had a curious relationship with the British press. And I would go a little further and say it was a very tough relationship with the British press. They seemed to watch your every move, comment on everything from your hairstyle to the shoes and clothes you wear, to a point where it almost became its own mythology. How could you cope with that daily onslaught on yourself and your family?
Well, of course, the first thing that my husband always says, it's so true, is that to complain about the press in British political life is like complaining about the British weather. I mean, it's just a given, and you have to accept that that's what you're getting into. I think the other thing about the press is that what I used to take some comfort about the fact that when I would go around the country and I'd meet lots of people, mm-hmm. and they would almost inevitably say two things to me. The first thing they'd say to me is, oh, you look much better in the flesh than in your photograph. And I think some of you may have read that Vanity Fair piece about, which I think was very Vanity Fair, so to be balanced, they put in all those horrible photographs. And one nice photograph that they took at the time. And, you know, it's a great comfort to me sometimes when people said I didn't really look like that. Because, frankly, if you really look like that, you would definitely want to kill yourself. And then the other thing they would say is that I wasn't what they expected. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, that's because we took a decision early on that I was not going to give interviews to the press. And that was because, you know, I was not the one who was elected. It was my husband who was elected, and the important thing, particularly for a Labour Party that was trying to take power after 18 years in the political wilderness, and particularly after a Labour Party who in 1992 had thought that their time was coming, and we were, you know, that they would in fact take power in 92, and then suddenly at the last minute to find it all going away again. Everything was geared to making sure that in 97, mm-hmm. or in 96, mm-hmm. because we, of course, didn't know when it was going to be, that nothing would go wrong. And the most important thing about that was to make sure there were no distractions from the message. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I could have been a distraction. Mm-hmm. Later on, I think, when we got into number 10, for the same reason, it was important that people knew what Tony and what his ministers wanted to communicate with them. Really, it wasn't important that they knew much about me because I was not the one who was elected. The problem was, of course, in today's 24-hour-a-day media, it's rather like, you know, the boy who sticks his finger in the hole in the dike. I mean, you cannot stop the sort of relentless tide of press interest. And therefore, because we weren't giving them anything, they filled that vacuum themselves. Mm-hmm. And so this rather strange creature was portrayed in the media who had all sorts of weird habits that, frankly, I didn't recognize in myself at all. You know, sometimes they would make me out to seem that I was such a completely wacky person that I'm amazed that I was possibly able to hold down a job as a lawyer and argue cases in the House of Lords. Or that actually, if I really believed some of the mad mumbo jumbo they said I believed, how come I was still a Catholic? I mean, you know, it was complete,
right.
Total fiction, but that was the way it was.
Out of all that fiction, and you talk about it so well, complaining about the Andre who did your hair or Carol, your friend. I mean, it was some of it was so frivolous, but it must have been hurtful at some point.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, I was only human, and in 1994, when Tony became leader of the Labour Party, I really wanted him to become leader, and I was absolutely prepared for the fact that it was going to change his life and there would be more interest in him. But it never crossed my mind that there would be interest in me as well.
Yeah.
And then to be suddenly thrust into that, it was quite a shock. And therefore, actually, when they started saying these things about you, in some ways it seemed quite sensible to retreat, because why actually put yourself forward?
Yes.
But I think as time went by that actually was a mistake, and that we might have done better to engage more fully with the press. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, because I wanted actually not to say you have to accept everything I say in the book. But, you know, I live my life as a lawyer, right? I put the case.
Yes.
And in our courts, in our system, you know, both sides of the case are put. And this was my chance to speak for myself and put the alternative.
Right.
But, you know, you were damned if you do and damned if you weren't.
So, yeah.
You know, you turn up the picture in the book of me on the day after the election, opening the door in my nightie with my hair, you know, the morning after the night before, as I thought as I opened the door, Tony will kill me. How could I be so stupid as to open the door like this? And yet at the same time, people were saying, well, you know, she spends all this money on a hairdresser. Yeah. You know, it was my money I was spending as well, but, you know. And of course, you have to, if you're representing your country, you know, you have to look decent, frankly. And, you know, I'm not a fashion model and I need help.
Don't we all? We all
we
do.
Yes,
we all do.
I tell you one thing, I'm very grateful. When Carla Bruni came to London last year for the state visit, I thought, thank God, I'm not the poor person who has to stand next to Carla Bruni, a supermodel, dressed in Dior, and take the comparison.
Exactly. You also talked about the challenging time when your husband became head of the Labour Party. And you said you went through a period of feeling more or less like a non-person, that here you were an educated woman with a professional life, very confident in that, and yet, was it his handlers? What was happening that caused all this self-questioning on your part?
Well, there was it's very difficult. I mean, I'd stood for Parliament myself, so I'd actually been a Labour candidate.
Right.
Tony and I had been very much an equal partnership, always had been. Of course, suddenly he becomes the leader of the party against that context of suddenly Labour has a chance to win. And therefore, it wasn't just about me and him anymore. It was about something much bigger than that. And therefore, there were a lot of other people who had views, not just about what he should do, but also about what I should do. And we went to our first Labour Party conference. Every year, the party has a big conference. And I'd been to Labour Party conferences before and had gone around and seen my friends. And suddenly I was told, you know, you must not leave the room unless you have a minder with you. And after a couple of days of this, I was going mad stuck up in this little room because Tony was busy doing various things. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, oh, this is ridiculous. So I sneaked down the back stairs and thought, I'll just go and find some friends. And I went down to the back stairs, stepped out into the main concourse area, saw one of my friends, went over there, and as I went over, suddenly, all these cameras and everything suddenly came around and surrounded me. You know, who's she talking to? Does that mean that Tony's going to be interested in some... sorry, the mic's going. Some problem or some policy. And I realized, actually, I couldn't just behave as though I was just another Labour Party member, because actually I was married to the party leader, and far from giving me a status, in some ways it also gave me a non-person, because it was too dangerous for me to say things in case people assumed that's what Tony believed. And that was so I felt almost voiceless.
Yeah.
At that stage. But you see, I think there's a real problem here. Not problem, but it goes back to what I'm saying, that I'm not the one who's elected. So actually, why should my views matter any more than anyone else's? And yet, on the other hand, because you have a platform, and because I did have a platform as the wife of the Prime Minister, I think it's important that you use it to try and make a difference and do some good. Therefore, you have to find a way, as an intelligent woman, to do that in a way which isn't party political and isn't threatening to the government programme, but which actually adds something to that.
Yes.
And, you know, that's why causes like breast cancer and help, you know, women's rights and working with children tend to be the sort of causes that you see, not just me, but all the other politicians' spouses that I've met doing.
Yes. As I read that section, I thought, what a wasted resource to have such a talented individual as part as a leading family in society, and yet not be allowed to voice opinions and be part, if you will, of the in crowd. But you got around it.
Yeah.
In so many ways. I thought what you did on Tuesdays, your Tuesdays receptions, was a very clever way of getting around it, and it might be a good lesson for our American first families. Could you tell us a bit about that?
When we came into Downing Street, we were very conscious that most people in Britain never get a chance to go behind that door. And we were the first family to go in there, you know, the first one with young children, and certainly living at home. So I wanted to do two things. One, I wanted to make sure that we got other young people to come in.
Yeah.
And to do that, we developed, not on the Tuesdays, but once a month, we would ask our local MPs to bring, each of them would bring three children from their constituency, because I wanted my children not to be the only children who got to see behind that black door. But we also wanted to bring in a lot more people than the sort of usual great and good that come to these events. And so what we did was we decided that I would throw open the house every Tuesday to charities. And people started to get to know, and they would write in, and I wouldn't select the charities. They would be selected by the office as to who would come.
Right.
And sometimes it would be a charity for the arts, sometimes it would be an international charity, sometimes it would be working with women or children or whatever it was.
Yeah.
But every week they would come, we'd have about 40 to 50 people.
Mm-hmm.
I would speak about their cause, and for me it was fantastic. You know, when things got tough in Downing Street, as they did, and you feel that things were not so good with the world, to meet people who, across our country, were really doing, often unsung, but fantastic work to make a difference in their community was so uplifting. And I'd also think, when you'd hear some of the stories, what am I got to complain about, you know?
Right.
So it was really, it made an amazing difference.
I also had the sense from your book that you really enjoyed your time at Chequers.
Yes.
And you got to meet some very interesting people on a one-to-one, on a person-to-person. So I'd be interested if you commented on your time with Princess Diana, for instance.
Well, we were very lucky, because we first met Diana when Tony was still leader of the opposition. And you were talking a bit about wasted resources, and I think that by this time, she felt very strongly that there was more that she could do to represent Britain abroad. You know, she'd done her landmine campaign.
Yeah.
And she'd been talking to Tony a bit about what she might do. And then after he was elected, she came to see us at Chequers, and she brought Prince William with her, who at that time was about, she's a bit older than you, and he must have been about 15. Mm-hmm. And they came just for Sunday lunch, yes. And they were very much just like anyone else, a mother and son coming to mm-hmm. our house. And there's a lovely picture in the book of my daughter Catherine, age 9. Diana's sitting on the grass in Chequers, and Catherine's sort of sitting between her knees. Yeah. And, you know, she was a very relaxed person. And Tony was talking about what more she might be able to do about the causes she felt passionately about. And then 6 weeks later, of course, she was dead. Yeah. So that was a great tragedy, and someone who had a lot to offer, that's for sure.
And tying that a bit with the historical moment and your husband's role in after Princess Diana died, and the movie, The Queen, which in part was a lot of our history of what. Was it accurate?
Well,
did you think?
I tell you that the first thing that struck me when I saw, you know, you see this movie, and I have to tell you that my husband and the Queen had a pact that neither of them were going to watch this movie, and certainly to my knowledge, Tony never has, and I'm sure the Queen is, I know the Queen is a woman who keeps her word, so I'm sure she hasn't either. Uh-huh. But I did watch it. I watched it I watched it on a plane at one point, and suddenly there's someone who apparently has your name and who's sort of vaguely in the same position as you, but they're not you. I mean, I remember thinking, I only wish I was that thin. So it was strange, and my daughter Catherine was very upset because the 9-year-old girl who plays Catherine in the movie has brown hair. Now, Catherine has very obviously, it's her Irish ancestry, has red hair, and she thought it was a bit cheapskate of the movie makers that they couldn't have least have hired a girl with red hair. The other thing that struck me is that my husband is actually 6 foot, and he's got quite a good body and a commanding presence. The actor was only about 5'8", and I didn't think he was half as sexy as my husband.
What do you... You've met the Queen.
I have.
You've
I've been very
fortunate. You've been at Balmoral with the Queen. You've slept in the same building with the Queen. And I think she picked up dishes, didn't she?
Well, the extraordinary thing is that the Prime Minister has a weekly audience with the Queen, but once a year, the Prime Minister and his wife are invited to spend the weekend with the royal family, particularly with the Queen and Prince Philip, in Balmoral, which is Queen Victoria's favourite castle in Scotland. And it still has the atmosphere of it, and some of the routines there are still the same as when Queen Victoria was there. This is a very sort of awe-inspiring thing from a girl like me, you know, who coming from a very ordinary background. And one of the things that you do at Balmoral is that as long as the weather is good, and actually for the whole 10 times we went to Balmoral, the weather always was good enough, you would go on one of the barbecues. Now, this is not like the barbecue that you and I would have in our own back garden. This is very much a royal barbecue. But Prince Philip would cook the food, which would be grouse stuffed with haggis, so not necessarily what you probably sent, you know, nothing like burgers or anything like that, or venison. And then at the end of the meal, the Queen and Prince Philip and the other members of the royal family would get up and they would clear away the plates. And, you know, your first reaction is to go... But the Queen was very insistent that that is what she would do. And we weren't the only guests. There were usually about 4 or 5 couples. Mm-hmm. So the Prime Minister, his wife, mm-hmm. the moderator of the Church of Scotland, who the next day would preach the sermon at Balmoral, mm-hmm. and then a couple of other couples as well. And that was it. So it was an extraordinary thing. But the Queen was always very kind to me, and I think she found it rather amusing that I found curtsying a little difficult. I do, really. I think I've always had 2 left feet, and though I did do some ballet classes when I was little, I'm afraid it was something I had to give up pretty quickly. And because I'm a barrister, and in court we bow to the Queen's representative, which is the judge, I was more comfortable bowing. And I think after the Queen saw my pathetic attempts at curtsying on the first couple of occasions, she was very happy that I should bow. But, you know, she was also terrific to Leo. And once Leo was born, and then that year after he was, as soon as he was born, I was still breastfeeding, so we took him up to Balmoral. And there's a wonderful picture, which isn't in the book, though there is a picture of Leo with the Queen and her corgis in the book. But in 2000, when he was born, the Queen Mother was still alive then, and Leo has a picture in his album of the Queen Mother, aged 100, holding Leo Blair, aged 4 months, which is an extraordinary thing to see someone born in 1900 with someone born in the year 2000. And then subsequently, after her mother died, the Queen then started to have her photograph taken with Leo. So he's a boy with the most amazing photo album. He's also got, we went to see the Pope, and there's a wonderful picture of Leo, aged 3. He made a little, we got him to draw a little drawing for the Pope, holding the drawing up to Pope John Paul, who's looking down at him. And it's such a, and we were very lucky because the Holy Father actually signed it for Leo, which, you know, is very special.
You mentioned that when you left 10 Downing on June 27th, 2007, that you left much wiser. Could you share some of these insights with us?
I hope that we all keep on learning, and I certainly learned. I think my husband was astonished at how diplomatic I really could be when I tried, which was a good thing. I'd also learnt, when I first went into Downing Street, you know, I wondered how the system, because in Britain, the civil service is a permanent civil service, and when the governments change, the civil service go on. And when you first come in to Downing Street on that first occasion, the civil servants in Downing Street have clapped out the previous Prime Minister just before you've arrived, and then they clap you in. And I remember coming in through the door and feeling very apprehensive about these people who had, after all, just spent 7 years serving John Major, who was of a different political party, and thinking, you know, how will this work? And then, actually, you soon learnt that, you know, their role was to support the Prime Minister, whatever his political persuasion. And though, of course, some of the people that came in were from our party as well. For many of the people who worked in Downing Street, the secretaries, who some of whom had been there for 20 or more years, the messengers who took the messages around the building, the custodians who you'd see opening and closing the door, the switchboard, they all became, because they would be there all the time, they would come with us to check us at the weekends, they would come with us on our holiday, they became part of our extended family. And so when it came for us to leave in 2007, and we came back after Tony had done the Prime Minister's questions for the last time, and they'd all stood up, which was unprecedented for them to clap at the end of the Prime Minister's questions. And then we came back with our children, we went up, and the staff from number 10 all came, and you know, many of them were in tears, and Tony spoke to them, and then at the end, I just said a few words on behalf of the family. And it was a terribly emotional event, and then we walked down the stairs, and they all lined up, and they clapped us out. And, you know, there was a real sense of a loss of friends. And then we stood on the doorstep, and they took our picture for the final time. And then Tony and I went for Tony to come and say goodbye to the Queen. And as I walked, of course, around the car, the press were shouting out, and they shouted out, you know, "Oh, bye, Cherie, we'll miss you." And I couldn't help myself. I just said, you know, "But I won't miss you." And so, though I learned many things, as Tony said to me when I got in the car, you know, "Haven't you learnt yet to bite your tongue?"
Well, it's good not to manage it all the time.
No,
I suspect. I think I remember reading in your book that you challenged at Checkers, I think it was,
our
president, yes, George Bush, on the issue of America's role in the International Court of Justice.
That was actually in Checkers. We had a very interesting debate with my children there as well, which was about the death penalty.
Oh, the death penalty.
But it's true. I also did raise the International Criminal Court, yes, court with him, but that was actually, you know, what a terrible guest. This was in his own house in Crawford. And it was something I felt very, very passionately about, because the international, as a lawyer and someone who deals with human rights, this whole quandary about how does the international community deal with people who've committed, you know, crimes against humanity and genocide, and yet they seem to be able to do that and not be held to account. And of course, the International Criminal Court was built on the experiences of the Yugoslav and Rwandan tribunals as a way of seeing whether we could hold people to account. And it was very much British government policy to support that.
Right.
And President Clinton, of course, one of the last things he did had been to sign the bill. Now, to be fair, of course, he knew that it was very unlikely that the Congress and the Senate would ratify that, because America has a difficult relationship over international treaties, and even the covenants on the rights of the child, which all the countries in the world apart from Somalia and the United States has signed, you know, has not been ratified by Congress.
Yeah.
So I think Bill realized that it probably wouldn't ever pass into law here, but it was a gesture of solidarity with the international community who were trying to deal with this issue. And then it started to be suggested that maybe America would do something which doesn't usually happen, which is actually take their signature off the treaty. And so when we were in Crawford, at one point, I knew it. I couldn't help but raise it with George. And he was very charming and you know, talked to me about it, and as he always is. And as we left that day, he said something to Tony about me raising it, because Tony was furious. He says, "Yeah, it's me who does the diplomacy, not you." And as we got into the car, George suddenly came out and said, "Now I know why Bill signed that treaty in the first place. It's all your fault," which of course wasn't true. But my efforts at diplomacy didn't work anyway, did they?
You traveled so much during your 10 years, and you met so many world leaders. Which one or two were the most impressive to you?
It's so difficult to decide that. You know, the extraordinary thing is, what I did find is that, you know, people don't rise to the top in politics, which is a tough thing to do, unless actually they are pretty impressive creatures. And the other thing I found was actually their spouses were also impressive creatures, which you don't always understand. For me, what an opportunity. I mean, to get to know Bill and Hillary Clinton, and then to know George and Laura Bush. And Laura is a great woman, and she and I went to Rwanda together to visit. We visited the genocide museum there, and she's very interested in literacy. She's very interested in helping other women. That was a great experience for me to meet two popes.
Yeah.
You know, not only John Paul, but also Pope Benedict.
Right.
Again, was a huge privilege. And then the silly things, like going to the White House for the first time and having Stevie Wonder sing Ma Cherie Amour for me. it's not very profound, but it was very at the time, I tell you, it was a big thrill. Or going on the boar hunt with President Putin. Not something that everybody does. That's for sure. And suddenly in the middle of the night, we went to see President Putin in his dasher, and we'd had dinner, and at the very end of dinner, he announced that he said, "Do we like hunting?" Well, you know, Tony and I hadn't actually ever held a gun, really, so. But he wanted to show us that, and so we went into we went outside. It was freezing cold outside. Of course, I was in my not long evening dress, but a short evening dress, and you know, heels like this. And off we went, and all I could remember was that actually boars are quite dangerous animals, and if they run at you, and you can have a nasty accident. And you know, Vladimir said, "You must be quiet." And of course, you know, the girls will know, but if you walk on high heels on a cold ground, it's very difficult to be quiet. So I was clattering along on my heels, click, click, and Tony kept saying, "Cherie, will you please be quiet?" And the more I tried to walk on my tiptoes, the louder it seemed to get. Fortunately, we got to the hide, and we didn't see any boars, and I wasn't knocked down, but there was a moment when I was convinced that my last hour was about to come.
If you thought of all the people you've met, which do you think could write the most interesting speaking for themselves?
Well, actually, at the moment, my husband is starting to write his own memoirs, some of which I've read, and I think you might be surprised at what he reveals in that book too. But you know, when I think about it. The one thing I've learnt when I've gone around the world is that there are so many amazing people around the world who never get the chance to tell their own stories. And so, you know, when I went to Afghanistan and I went to the biggest girls' school in Kabul and I met the head teacher there who is now managing a school with 8,000 girls aged between 5 and 21. And why were they 21? Because, of course, when they were 5, they weren't getting any education at all, because the Taliban actually thought so little of women that it was all right not to allow them to be educated, something which, you know, absolutely appalls me and which we mustn't ever say is acceptable. And she had been a teacher before the Taliban and had gone underground and run classes for girls. Mm-hmm. And now she was managing this school. And I went to the school and, you know, it had so few facilities. And since that time, I've helped with fundraising for them. When you think the story she could tell, or the women I met in Rwanda who'd been through the genocide and who subsequently, you know, having been raped and seen their children killed, and were now rebuilding their country, sometimes looking after orphans of other women. And you saw them there, you know, the backbone of their community, standing on their two feet. You know, there's something terribly rooted about African women that makes me feel, you know, sometimes we, you know, who have so much and who worry so much about, you know, what our hair looks like and whether we, you know, whether my bum looks big in these trousers, you know, and then you see people who really are dealing with issues and you realize just how trivial some things really are. And that's something else that grounded me. However bad I might have felt my problems were with the press or whatever else, I was just so lucky to be born when I was and to have the opportunities that I have.
Yeah, it's a good reflection, a good reminder for all of us, in fact. I can see that our time is up. It's gone so quickly, but I must go to one last part of your book, get one more. Dr. Lucy, I'm almost done. You said that you described your book as a memoir of someone who for a period of time had a walk-on part in history. So as your final comment, could you share with us what you think was your most important walk-on part?
Well, I tell you, I think if you asked any mother that question, then the answer is obvious, isn't it? The most important walk-on part that I could possibly do is to bring my children up to the best of my ability so that they are able to walk tall and proud in the world. And the other thing I think my role was in number 10, more than anything else, was to support my wonderful man who had the most difficult and demanding job in our country, and to make sure that whatever else happened, he knew that I was always there for him.
Thank you, Cherie Blair.
Well, Mrs. Blair has kindly agreed to some questions from the audience, so please raise your hands.
I want to say thank you so much just for coming to Marin County. I have been a fan of yours for many, many years. I used to watch Parliament, and I still do, and I brought my children up to do so. My question to you is, you've arrived in a very political time for us. In the next 2 to 3 weeks, we'll be having a big decision, this nation. Have you met either Obama or McCain?
My husband has met both of them, but I haven't. And when Tony met them, I was rather hoping that I would meet their spouses, but actually neither of them brought their spouses on the visit, so it wasn't really appropriate for me to go as well, which was a shame. But you're absolutely right. The whole world is watching this election now, and I'm afraid I'm a bit of an election groupie. I've been, of course, and fought in elections, and to see there's something about elections that is just so powerful, because you actually are seeing people make a choice when actually every individual can make a difference. And that's an incredibly powerful thing. And I can remember in 97 when suddenly, as I said, we were the ones who seemed to be the front runners. And that's a terribly, you know, it's actually quite a frightening thing to be, because you can never take the electorate for granted. And whatever the opinion polls say, the only poll that matters is the one that happens on polling day. And you can never be sure about what might happen up until that time. And Tony throughout was very focused on the fact that we really had to fight for every vote, and that you couldn't be sure what was happening. And I'm sure at the moment that's exactly where all the candidates are at the moment, fighting for every vote, because no one really knows what's going to happen on the 4th of November. But all of you, of course, will play a part.
I have one more question. You have open parliament where you are able to converse in a very intellectual way. It's absolutely wonderful. It's such an art. And we've had our debates. And for you, watching our debates, can you comment of what you think either candidate is lacking?
Oh, I think that would be invidious for me to do, but it's interesting, isn't it? Because we do have Prime Minister's question time, where every week, and I can tell you, every week Tony sweated over that, and we never did anything on Tuesday night. I did my receptions for the charities, but he was back preparing for Prime Minister's questions, and he never, ever took that for granted. But we never, ever had a debate between the candidates in the way that you do. And, of course, it's a fascinating thing. And actually, your presidential election is an amazing thing. Anyone who goes through that, by the end of that experience, the American people really have a very good idea about what they're like and how they, you know, how they endure such a campaign. So there's no doubt at all, when you make your choice on the 4th of November, it will be an informed choice.
Well, while I move over to the next question, there is a question from the audience that says, have you thought about running for public office? And if so, in what position?
I think that I was for 24 years the wife of an MP, and then 10 years as the wife of the Prime Minister. In 1983, I did stand for Parliament, but I was in this hopeless seat. And I always remember, for poor Tony, it was a terrible experience, because, do you know what, if you think it's difficult being the candidate or the head of government, try being the spouse. And I think the role of the First Lady is quite a delicate one, and I think some people do it well, and not every man is as good as that. I think Bill Clinton actually, you know, Hillary was a fantastic First Lady. I think Bill found being the First Lady a little more difficult than Hillary. But there was a wonderful moment in 1983 when I was the candidate, when Tony hadn't got a seat, and therefore he came along with me to talk with my campaign manager about what we were going to do in the election that was coming. And we'd had lunch with the Kim and his wife, and at the end of the lunch, he said to my campaign manager, said to Tony, "Tony, would you mind leaving us for a moment while Cherie and I talk politics?" So poor Tony had to trot back and dry the dishes while the wife washed up the dishes. And she said to him as he was obediently drying the dishes, "Tony, are you interested in politics at all, or do you just do this for Cherie?" Now, I can assure you that that was one of the worst days in Tony's life. And I couldn't possibly do that to him all over again.
Okay, I have the mic, so I'll ask a question. I really want to gossip more about the Bushes, but I'll ask you a more serious question. What did you think about the book London, A Stand? Because we have issues about immigration in the United States, and it's a big issue, I think, and it's a human rights issue, people wanting to find a better life. But do you feel that it is still an issue in England and Britain, and how do you feel about that?
I haven't actually read the book, but I have read reviews about the book, so I know what you're talking about. I think there is a real, you know, in globalization, we live in a globalized world now, and there are so many people, I've seen for myself, living in poor countries who actually all they want is a chance of a better life. And in today's world, it's so much easier to move around, and yet so many people are exploited in that. The moment I'm involved in a campaign about trafficking in women and girls, and you know, there are so many vulnerable people who think they're coming to a better life and then find themselves caught up in you know, horrendous situations. On the other hand, of course, there are problems with migration, and it has to be managed so that it's fair both to the people who are moving and the host community. And it's a really difficult issue for politicians to grapple with. And I know within the churches, of course, the churches do great work supporting people who are coming to our country. And particularly in our country, we have questions of asylum seekers. But it's a really hard judgment to make. And not everybody can be an economic migrant. And you have to have a balance there. You know, but the individual decisions are very hard ones, and for the individual lives. That's why, actually, it's a really difficult job to be a leader of the country and to try and make decisions that are good for everybody. And you have to, what you actually, in the end, are choosing your politicians for are because you trust their judgment. And I think we should always remember that. And the thing I find most difficult is when people actually question the good faith of our politicians. I've met loads of politicians, and most of them, whatever their political views, some of whom may share my political views, some of them may not, most of them actually do not go into politics cynically to feather their own nest. They actually go into politics out of a sense of public service. And I think there's a huge danger in the way some of the reporting now goes on about politics, that we actually put off good people into coming into politics, particularly when you then start also attacking their, you know, if it's not their spouse, it's their children or their mother, because you might be prepared to put yourself forward as a politician, but you may then think, but can I really do that to the more vulnerable members of my family? And if we start putting off good people, we still will have people putting themselves forward for election, but actually they may not be the people that we would really want. So I think this whole question is a really delicate one. Yes, we must hold our politicians to account, but we do have to be careful how we do it. So I didn't actually, I think I digressed from your
Blair,
question.
I've been an admirer of your husband for a long time. However, I think that everybody here could safely say that it's in the charm area, he has a big competitor with his wife.
Oh, you can come again.
Now that I've warmed you up.
Oh, I know. Something horrible is now going to be out.
Yeah, something like this. This is a political question, and I was wondering if you'd share your view about the evolution of Britain's support of the Iraq War and what you thought of that support.
Well, in the book, of course, I describe not the politics of the Iraq War, because that's not my story to tell. I mean, you know, that's the story that you will hear when Tony writes his memoir. But I'd more describe what it was like to live through that experience, to live with a man who was firmly convinced, rightly convinced, that Saddam Hussein was a danger to the world, rightly convinced that Saddam Hussein was taking the United Nations for a ride in ignoring all the resolutions, who was desperately trying to see whether we could find a solution through the United Nations. And I was there when he, at 5 o'clock in the morning, he'd be ringing some member of the Security Council to try and persuade them to support a resolution. And at midnight that same night, he might be talking to another member, trying to see whether there is another way of dealing with that. I also describe a little bit what it's like to be living in number 10 at a time when outside, for me and my children when we were going out, were people standing at the door with Blair liar and shouting murderer at a man you knew actually was a man of integrity. And so this was an interest, you know, for me... and for my children, a real challenge. I also, of course, describe in the book how in 2002, I actually had a miscarriage. So then I was 40, nearly 47, and, you know, and so I was fairly early on in my pregnancy, and we hadn't said a word to anybody. We wanted to keep it private, and I just had a miscarriage at the moment that we were supposed to go on holiday, and as a result of that, we had to postpone going on holiday. And I was lying there bleeding, not to be too graphic, but, and Tony rang up and said, "We have to speak to Alistair about this." And, and he said, "We have to make an announcement to the press about why I'm not going on holiday. Because if we don't make an announcement to the press, and the speculation about whether our troops are going to be moved into Iraq, if I suddenly cancel my holiday, you know, people will think something's going to happen. We can't afford to do that." So there I am, lying there, really at a most private moment, realizing that even at that point, because I'm married to the Prime Minister, even the most private things sometimes have to become public. And that's quite a difficult thing to live with.
Cherie, as a final closing question, we'd like to ask you, as the door closed at number 10 and you were on the other side and in that automobile, was there a collective exhale, and how has your family life radically changed in this little over a year?
Well, certainly that there was in some ways, because there comes a time, and Tony always said this, and I talk a bit about that in the book, that, you know, political life, in the end, you have to move on. You cannot carry on doing a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week job forever. And actually, politics is about change. And there comes a time when you really do have to pass on. But actually, if you ask me, would I do it all again? Absolutely. Was it worth everything? Absolutely. Is it different now? Well, For me, in many ways, it's better, because now, actually, I can speak for myself. And if I say something about the International Criminal Court, or if I say something about women's rights, people don't automatically assume that that's the view of my husband or that's the British government policy. So for me, that is very liberating. And for Tony, too, of course, being the man he is, he goes from one difficult and demanding job and goes and takes an even more difficult and demanding job, being the Middle East envoy. If anyone can help that process along, I'm convinced it's Tony. The disadvantage from our family is that now, because he spends 10 days a month in Jerusalem, we actually see less of him than when he was Prime Minister. As Prime Minister, we lived on the premises. You'd never go away for more than about 2 or 3 days because you have to be, your job is to run the country and therefore you have to be in the country. And so actually for Leo and I, who are still at home, our older children now, of course, are in their 20s, we actually see less of him than we used to, which we don't like so much.
Cherie, I think on behalf of the entire audience, Françoise and Denise Lucy, you are utterly charming and amazing. We really enjoyed this evening. Thank you so
much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Cherie will be signing your book. There's more books to purchase here, but we'll be lining up on this side here and putting post-its on your book. Thank you for coming this evening.
Well, there you go, ladies and gentlemen, live from Angelico Hall on the campus of Dominican University of California. A beautiful evening with Cherie Blair, wife of the ex-prime minister of England, Tony Blair. And you heard it right here on radio.dominican.edu. Of course, this broadcast will be available on our website for download should you desire to listen to it again, or you could even save it and preserve it forever. Either way, I thank you for listening in tonight. A great evening. Another magnificent event in the series from the Institute of Leadership Studies here at Dominican University of California. Thanks again for listening. And I hope everybody has a great evening. Radio.dominican.edu.